Today is Thursday, May 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. More than 4.3 million COVID-19 cases have been found worldwide. And in Japan, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe lifts a state of emergency in large parts of the country. Plus, the U.S. economy doesn't look likely to rebound anytime soon.
The recovery may take some time to gather momentum.
And we take a look at the palm oil industry.
Usually what happens with these companies is they suspend them and then some of these companies then decide we've got to do things different.
Those stories and more are next. With more than 4.3 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 worldwide, but only just over 16,000 domestically, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe lifted a state of emergency in large parts of the country, but said it remains in place in Tokyo and Osaka until the novel coronavirus is contained. Elsewhere, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said most of his country will move toward relaxing coronavirus restrictions later this month, even as the number of confirmed cases tops 12,000. In the United States, the Midwestern state of Wisconsin's Supreme Court struck down a statewide coronavirus stay-at-home order on Wednesday. The court approved a legal challenge from Republican lawmakers who said the state's top public health official exceeded her authority by imposing restrictions. While lockdown orders meant to quell the pandemic have been challenged in courts in several states, the decision in Wisconsin marks the first such lawsuit to succeed in a larger political debate over social distancing that has grown increasingly partisan. The United States currently has about 1.4 million confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus. And for additional information on the pandemic, visit voanews.com. French pharmaceutical group Sanofi says it will make its COVID-19 vaccine, when it is ready, available to all countries. The statement on Thursday came hours after the company's CEO said the United States would get the first access. Sanofi CEO Paul Hudson's comments prompted angry reaction from the French government, saying the move would be unacceptable. The United Nations is calling for mental health care to be given to millions of people suffering from psychological distress from fear, loneliness, economic upheaval, and any abuse triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic. Lisa Schlein has that story.
National surveys carried out this year reveal widespread prevalence of distress in populations, with levels as high as 35% in China, 60% in Iran, and 45% in the United States. Similar studies among healthcare workers find anxiety levels have risen an average of 45% in countries such as Canada, China, and Pakistan. Devorah Kestel is director of the World Health Organization's Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse. She says measures must be taken now to protect and promote care for such existing conditions.
This is something that needs to be done in the middle of the crisis so that we can prevent things to become worse in the near future. We are all witnessing in every country of the world the risk of an economic turmoil that will affect people.
Kestel says mental health problems have surged during similar economic crises in the past, leading to high rates of suicide. One of the major recommendations in the UN Secretary General's policy brief is to ensure mental health and psychosocial support are widely available in any emergency. What may be feasible in rich countries may not be possible in the developing world. For example, WHO notes one in five people in South Sudan has a mental health condition, with only one professional available for every 4 million people. Kestel tells VOA that the WHO and other agencies have been working for years to strengthen the capacity of non-mental health professionals to provide care.
We are promoting the modalities where the community, some community leaders or sectors within the community, such as traditional healers in some contexts, could receive the basic knowledge and training that is needed in order to provide care to those in need.
The United Nations says psychological trauma will remain after COVID-19. The disease caused by the coronavirus is gone. It urges nations to reform, strengthen, and invest more money in their mental health care systems. It says these services will be needed to support societies as they recover from the terrible consequences of this life-changing event. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A U.S. government whistleblower who says he was forced out of his job for raising alarm about the coronavirus pandemic is offering a sobering prediction of what the nation may face in the coming months. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Mirghani takes things from here.
Dr. Rick Bright says unless officials develop a national coordinated response to avoid a second virus wave, he fears the pandemic will get far worse and America will face the darkest winter in modern history. Bright says he was pushed out of leading a government research agency after warning the Trump administration to prepare for the pandemic. He'll tell a House panel today the window of opportunity is closing and officials must act. His warning comes after Dr. Anthony Fauci said this week the nation could face needless death and suffering if restrictions are lifted too soon. Sagar Mirghani, Washington.
An Australian parliamentary report has debunked a conspiracy theory linking COVID-19 to 5G technology. Phil Mercer has more.
The COVID-19 pandemic has brought disparate groups of conspiracy theorists together. Some believe the disease was deliberately spread around the world to force vaccines onto the population as a form of control. Others assert that a Harvard University professor was arrested for creating and selling the coronavirus to China. Others insist that 5G technology is the true cause of COVID-19. It was a view that was reportedly first promoted in a social media video in March and has been shared widely on the internet. However, linking the new coronavirus to radio waves simply isn't true, according to a report by an Australian Parliamentary Communications Committee. It found that 5G technology was safe. E-communications experts say linking COVID-19 to radio waves has no basis in science and is biologically and physically impossible. This is a view shared by the World Health Organization and other authorities. They have found that 5G radiation can't penetrate skin or allow a virus to penetrate skin. In Australia, New South Wales state health officials have asserted that COVID-19 wasn't spread through mobile networks or wireless technology, but through infected droplets from coughing or sneezing, or by contact with contaminated hands, surfaces, or objects. Australia's Chief Medical Officer Brendan Murphy has also dismissed a link between 5G networks and the disease.
There's unfortunately a lot of very silly misinformation out there. There is absolutely no evidence about 5G doing anything in the coronavirus space. I have unfortunately received a lot of communication from these conspiracy theorists myself. It is complete nonsense. 5G has got nothing at all to do with coronavirus.
Academics say that fake news and misinformation seem to be spreading as fast and as far as the virus itself. Uncertainty and fear breed confusion, and as one expert said, conspiracy theories offer an emotionally satisfying narrative, even if they're not true. There have been small protests in Australia by groups angry at lockdown measures and at the government's coronavirus mobile phone tracing app. Demonstrators in Melbourne also sought to link an outbreak of the virus at a meat plant to a nearby telephone tower. Efforts are being made to sort the truth from the lies. YouTube has said it will do more to remove content linking 5G technology to COVID-19. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
World markets traded lower Thursday in reaction to a gloomy assessment about the struggles facing the global economy due to the coronavirus pandemic. Japan's Nikkei index was down 1.7%, while Hong Kong had lost almost a point and a half. Indices in Seoul, Shanghai, Sydney, and Taipei closed lower Europe's key markets were down more than 3%, and in early trading, the U.S. indices were off about 2%. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, in a sober review of where the U.S. economy stands on the cusp of its reopening, warned on Wednesday of an extended period of weak growth and stagnant incomes, pleaded to use more of the central bank's power as needed, and issued a call for additional fiscal spending. Reuters' Conway G. Gittins has that story.
The recovery may take some time to gather momentum.
Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell delivered a word of warning Wednesday as parts of the U.S. economy begin to reopen. Don't expect a quick economic rebound. Though the Federal Reserve has taken unprecedented steps to limit the fallout from the economic crisis brought on by the coronavirus pandemic, Powell said it is likely the recovery will be slower than hoped, leading to an extended period of weak growth.
The record shows that deeper and longer recessions can leave behind lasting damage to the productive capacity of the economy. Avoidable household and business insolvencies can weigh on growth for years to come. The loss of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses across the country would destroy the life's work and family legacy of many businesses and community leaders and limit the strength of the recovery when it comes. The result could be an extended period of low productivity growth and stagnant incomes.
But Powell wasn't all doom and gloom, saying in a webcast the recovery will eventually come, and pledged the Fed would continue to do all it can to make sure that happens. That, however, will not include a push in interest rates to below zero. President Trump has repeatedly urged for so-called negative interest rates.
The committee's view on negative rates really has not changed. This is not something that we're looking at. We chose not to implement negative rates during the global financial crisis and the recovery, and instead we relied, as you pointed out, on forward guidance and asset purchases when we were at the near the zero bound. And we've said that we intend to continue relying on those tools, which are tried and they are now a part of our toolkit.
But Powell warned that more stimulus is needed, and for that, he took the rare step of calling out the White House and Congress, urging the two to step up with more fiscal spending.
That was Reuters reporter Conway G. Gittins. And still coming up later in today's program.
We're now some months on from the day that you came to Washington when President Trump announced that vision for peace when you were there. There remains work yet to do, and we need to make progress on that. I'm looking forward to it.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Health experts say it may be 12 to 18 months until a COVID-19 vaccine will be available for public use. But what can be done to help protect us now? Scientists, including those who've written a new study published in the International Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine, suggest using passive immunization, a technique that may provide short-term protection. When someone is exposed to a virus, their immune system starts creating antibodies to fight the infection. The scientists propose collecting coronavirus antibodies from those who recovered from COVID-19. The antibodies, in the form of purified plasma, would then be transferred into recently infected patients, where it could eliminate the virus from the bloodstream and provide a temporary boost in immunity. The authors of the new study cite evidence from previous pandemics of the technique's effectiveness. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A truck packed with explosives blew up near a court in the eastern Afghan city of Gardez on Thursday, killing at least 5 people in the attack claimed by Taliban insurgents. The explosion comes 2 days after at least 56 people were killed in attacks elsewhere in the country, including women and newborn babies, dealing a setback to peace plans in the war-ravaged nation. President Ashraf Ghani condemned Tuesday's attacks and said he had ordered the military to switch to offensive mode rather than the defensive stance it had adopted as the United States withdraws troops and tries to broker talks with the Taliban. The Taliban denied any involvement in the Tuesday attacks on the hospital, but the government accused the group of fostering an environment in which terrorism thrives or of working with other militant groups who could have been involved. Senior Fellow and Director of Research for Brookings and the Center on 21st Century Security and Intelligence at Brookings, Michael O'Hanlon, told VOA via Skype the increase in attacks may affect the peace deal the United States reached with the Taliban in February.
I am afraid that increased violence could seem to be in very poor, faith and very much at counter purposes to the negotiating concept that the United States tried to establish with the Taliban. And that phase one deal could only make any sense if it led to serious negotiations on phase two, which of course would then focus on the Afghan government and any broader group of Afghan political and civil society leaders it wished to bring together dealing with the Taliban. So for that kind of a process to have any meaningful traction, it seems to me that it's difficult to sustain it or even get it going when the Taliban increase the level of violence. We know that historically, many adversaries keep fighting while they negotiate. And sometimes they even step up the pace of fighting to improve their position and to show their strength during any negotiation. So it's not completely unprecedented that the Taliban would do this. But because I'm already so pessimistic about the prospects for a peace deal, I get worried when I see the Taliban actually increase its use of violence at this juncture.
After three deadlocked and divisive elections, Israel is finally swearing in a new government, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu securing a historic fifth term in office thanks to a controversial power-sharing deal with rival-turned-partner Benny Gantz. Netanyahu and Gantz, a former military chief, announced last month they would be putting their differences and animosity aside after three hard-fought campaigns to join forces to steer the country through the coronavirus crisis and its severe economic fallout. The deal calls for Netanyahu to serve as prime minister for the government's first 18 months before being replaced by Gantz. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Wednesday made a day-long trip to Israel, where he held meetings with Israeli officials. The talks focused on shared concerns about Iran and the Trump administration's peace plan, which allows Israel to annex almost one-third of the West Bank and could spark new tension in the Middle East. Linda Gradstein has that story.
Wearing a red, white, and blue face mask, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was the first top official to visit Israel since the COVID-19 pandemic began. He told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that it was exactly 2 years ago that U.S. President Donald Trump moved the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, a move that most Israelis welcomed. Now, Pompeo said, it is time to move forward with President Trump's peace plan.
We're now some months on from the day that you came to Washington when President Trump announced that vision for peace when you were there. There remains work yet to do, and we need to make progress on that. I'm looking forward to it.
Prime Minister Netanyahu said the United States and Israel have cooperated in the fight against the coronavirus and on Iran. He thanked the U.S. for maintaining an arms embargo on Iran and said he, too, wants to move forward on the peace plan.
Now we're about to form a national unity government tomorrow. I think that this is an opportunity to promote peace and security based on the understandings that I reached with President Trump in my last visit in Washington in January.
The plan allows Israel to impose sovereignty over almost one-third of the West Bank, which includes most of the Jewish settlements. It is a stark reversal of American policy, which until President Trump had seen the settlements as illegal. Palestinians say the West Bank must be part of a future Palestinian state and have warned Israel against the annexation. Several European countries, including France, Spain, Ireland, and Sweden, say they will not accept the annexation. While some sanctions would require the unanimous agreement of the European Union, others, like trade agreements, do not. Israeli political analyst Nimrod Goren of the Mitvim Institute says there have been growing tensions between Israel and the EU, which is headquartered in Brussels.
There is a growing negative stance from Jerusalem towards Brussels, and when European states and foreign ministers have been voicing in recent weeks their opposition to Israeli annexation intentions, that led to another very strong reaction from Jerusalem towards Brussels, and that's one of the things that the new Israeli government should try and change, because Europe eventually is a strategic partner of Israel and quite a close friend.
An Israeli annexation of part of the West Bank is also likely to spark tensions with Jordan, which controlled the area until 1967. The peace treaty with Israel has been increasingly unpopular with the public in Jordan, although the countries have strong security ties. According to the guidelines of a new unity government between Netanyahu and former rival Benny Gantz, Israel can move ahead with annexation beginning in July. But in fewer than 2 weeks, Netanyahu's trial on graft and corruption charges is scheduled to begin. It is difficult to know whether the Israeli leader will move ahead with the annexation as a way of diverting attention from this trial, or if he will feel that the international condemnation is too high a price to pay. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
According to Greenpeace, a global environmental group, palm oil suppliers to the world's largest food and cosmetic companies have cleared more than 1,300 square kilometers of rainforest since 2013. Scientists say deforestation is a dominant driver of climate change and massive biodiversity loss in the Earth's tropical rainforest. Recently, a group of major corporations and palm oil suppliers and traders suspended Samling, a palm oil and timber conglomerate, from their supply chains as punishment for what they say is Samling's reckless clear-cutting of Malaysia's rainforest. Now, to find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Phil Aikman via Zoom. He's the Southeast Asia campaign director for Mighty Earth, a Washington-based nonprofit that focuses on deforestation issues across the tropics. Aiken said that although Samling is a giant player in industrial palm agriculture, industry sanctions against one of their own is nothing new.
This has been going on to some degree for the last decade or so. A lot of environmental organizations have been lobbying these companies to enforce their policies, to make sure their policies prevent this thing from happening on the ground. This is one good example, I would say, but there are many others.
What was their abuse at Samling?
The company is basically clearing remaining rainforests in Sarawak, and they are developing monoculture timber plantations. And that is in breach of palm oil traders' policies. At the moment, the company is trying to work out what it needs to do and trying to make sure they don't lose any more business. At the same time, I think a lot of people are saying that their actions so far have been inadequate.
Now, I know that it's Lynn Ely Plantations, which is a Samling-owned palm oil company, has declared a moratorium on further oil palm development and issued a no deforestation policy. Will that satisfy you?
They've issued a policy for one company in the conglomerate. It doesn't address the clearing that has been highlighted.
What usually happens when one of these companies gets kicked out of the supply chain by the other companies in the consortium?
Usually what happens with these companies is they suspend them, and then some of these companies then decide we've got to do things differently, and they then ask what they need to come back in. So there are cases now where companies are actually remedying their past impacts and they have to compensate.
How does that work?
They would have to calculate how much forest they'd lost within a certain time frame, and then they would have to come up with a plan to either restore some forest areas or protect an equivalent area of forest.
Now, the motivation for many of these companies and palm oil suppliers and traders to try to halt deforestation isn't just a matter of altruism. Isn't it also more profitable to let these forests stand and let indigenous people, for example, steward them?
Well, 10 years ago, that wasn't the case. People were making money off clearing forests. A lot of these palm oil companies were expanding into forest areas. Now they're seeing it's not a good business model anymore. So they're now seeking to try and protect those forests as part of their new look, so to speak. And we're kind of seeing that also in other sectors like the soy sector in South America and even the cocoa sector in West Africa as well.
If Samling's supply chain for palm oil is mostly frozen after this and they're not making any more profit, it's hard to see why they wouldn't toe the line at this point.
They're a big conglomerate, so they're involved in timber, palm oil, rubber, various other industries. So they have other markets, obviously. So we're hoping that they will stop clearing their timber operations. But it's too early to tell which direction they want to go. Do they want to turn over a new leaf and sort of join the rest of the pack and say, okay, we will no longer clear, or do they continue to clear and kind of try and find other markets to sell their products to? But basically, at the moment, they've lost a big part of their revenue.
So you at Mighty Earth must be very pleased by this development.
It's definitely a good first step. If the company continues to clear, we will just have to find other ways to try and influence them.
Phil Aikman is the Southeast Asia Campaign Director for Mighty Earth. He was speaking to our own Adam Phillips. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a thoughtful Thursday.